Hey everyone, I'm super, super excited to have with us a very, very special guest, a big rock star in multiple, multiple ways here with us today on the Founder Stories podcast. Today we have the absolute honor to host our dear friend, Ron. Ron is a serial entrepreneur. He's currently the founder of a great company called Empathy, which he's going to get into and explain to us what their mission is and their purpose for the creation and their purpose in this world for making a difference. Besides that, Ron is an incredible, incredible individual. He is a father to beautiful children, a great husband, and we'll confirm with his wife afterwards to ask if that's true. And he's an all-around great guy. I am super excited not only to learn about Ron and his journey about empathy, but also his personal journey of how he becomes the best version of himself possible. So join us on this journey. And Ron, welcome to the show.
Frank, thank you for that. Very kind intro. Definitely need to hang out with you more often so I get to be introduced by you and more and more places.
Anytime. I'm here in New York. Fly me down to Israel. Come join with you. I'll be your right-hand man. But Ron, let's take this all the way back. You're a serial entrepreneur. You work on your second startup. If you had to start the journey all over again, back from the beginning, walk me through, what would you do?
The main thing about starting a company is being curious. And at the same time, that also means being naive. And I get to wear my, I guess, pink rose glasses all the time as a founder. And naivety is something that you gradually lose when you have more and more context, more knowledge, and more macro considerations. So the one thing you want to hold on to is being naive. And I wish I could actually be as naive today as I was, 25 when I started the Gifts Project with friends and family and had a great educating experience in the social commerce world. But I can't. Once you know something or you've been educated how to do something by startups or even Fortune 500 companies, it's tough to get that sense of naivety back, but definitely never lose curiosity is what I would tell myself.
Are there any steps currently right now that you do to not lose that?
Well, in terms of naivety, it's very hard, but in terms of the balance with curiosity, is like always asking questions, always adopting the outsider view and really playing your ignorance for what it's worth, especially when you walk into a new category. For us this year, we've learned so much about life insurance, for example, which is a very traditional, massive, profitable, traditional industry that's been there for hundreds of years. And it's just great to challenge that with questions and get to ask, why do you need that piece of paper? Or why do you really need that? And why aren't you also doing this? And a lot of the time, most of the time, you get it wrong. And there's a very good reason why something is not being done. But sometimes there's actually no reason. Or a legacy reason that is outdated.
So for founders starting today, because everybody wants to be a founder these days. Every kid that's graduating from the army.
Really? Even in this macro environment? Come on, that must have changed.
Well, the way the world is currently right now is that the new celebrities are people like yourself. They're not movie stars. Every kid either wants to become the next TikTok star, YouTube shorts, or they want to become an entrepreneur. They see Elon Musk, they see Mark Zuckerberg. You are the new celebrities these days of what every single individual child or every kid that's graduating college wants to become. So in one sense, it's a responsibility. In one sense, it's also obviously to the new young kids out there, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Speak from your journey. I mean, you had that incredible experience of being able to launch a startup to a certain degree before startups were even cool.
Look, we are operating from New York and from Tel Aviv. And Israel, as you know, is a very unique place. I think the last few decades, the startup nation got to evolve. Many would call it now the scale-up nation, as coined by my partner and board member, Michael Eisenberg. But most importantly, I think we shifted from a very risk-averse nation that is healing from a terrible war and the Holocaust and just the foundation of the country, gradually to become accepting of risk. And that as a whole is a good thing. I think there's always a balance. I think in 2020, you would walk the streets of Tel Aviv and you would feel like nobody wants to get any work done but to start a company or a nonprofit. And it's not a good balance. When nobody wants to build a house, nobody wants to be a taxi driver, everyone wants to start a company. Starting a company is very dangerous. It's almost insane when you look at statistics. So I feel like overall, it's a very positive trend that we shifted from, if you look back, my mom got married when she was 19. She was secular, but the concept of a shidduch was still there. And she was introduced to an electric engineer, someone with stability and a good baseline as a defense and for what could happen. That's not the case anymore, right? People are not looking for a safe way necessarily when you generalize, but people have an appetite to go over and take a bite of the whole world and see what they can do.
I absolutely love that. So what can we do? Like, I mean, what's the bite that you're trying to take? And for others too, because, you know, that bite can be translated. And I'd love to hear what you mean by that bite, because in my mind, it could be translated in multiple different ways. It could be, you know, meaning the person that wants to make their mark in the world, the person that wants to accomplish much more than being a, let's say, for example, a local technician, which is a great thing in itself. But some people are just not that style. They want to go ahead, become something bigger, create something bigger, things like that.
Look, again, it's a part of a very positive trend that you get to be higher on the Maslow pyramid and say, you know what, I care about self-fulfillment. I care about a mission. I care about a purpose. And that needs to come in a world where people already have some income or already have some knowledge or basically the basic needs are covered. So when you zoom out, it's great that you see more and more mission-driven companies in Silicon Valley, in New York, and definitely here in Israel. People are trying to save lives, improve quality of life, save burdens for others, support mental health, look at climate change, and just do what technology is doing best of connecting the dots and adding workflows and streamlining information in order to be an accelerator. When I think about a bite, I mean, like everyone's really, more and more people are trying to be their best version of themselves. That has a good side, but it also has implications. This is a generation that has been told, many of us, the sky's the limit, a different version of the American dream. A lot of people here and in America are going to, at some point, face reality that life is short and maybe everything is possible, but there's not enough time to do all these possible things at a point where you already have meaningful obligations. And that, I always say that entrepreneurship is not correlated with age, but commitment is. So I didn't take much risk when I started my first company. My alternative cost was just not that big of a deal. And I operated in an environment that even if I fail miserably, that experience would actually be thought highly of. And, you know, to do that, when you're older, you have dependents that look at you and you need to take care of them one way or another, it's harder. And it's not because of age, it's because of a commitment. A startup is a huge commitment. It's commitment to take value from people and bring it back with outsized returns. So that's something I would not recommend, but some of your audience and listeners already made a decision, right? They want to be the man in the arena. They don't want to hear the naysayers. They want to go after and fulfill their dream. And, you know, sometimes that motivation is a great force.
There's different things you mentioned right now that are like really hitting home and it's making me think. And there's multiple parts of me that are constantly feeling the things that you spoke about. I want to touch upon the first thing and then we'll get into the multiple things you just mentioned. Because you mentioned a bunch of things that are able to be broken down to so many different conversations. I want to touch upon the first thing of meaning. What is meaning to you? And I don't want to make it into a very philosophical conversation, but I think entrepreneurship and life and daily life are mixed together. It's not two separate things. It's all about integration. You know, it's not like I'm a founder, I'm an entrepreneur, then I have my own personal life. It's one person, one you. You know, you have different responsibilities where you have to show up in different places in life, but it's one you. What does meaning mean to you?
I think if you jumpstart a company that is truly mission-driven, that doesn't need a linkage. You don't need to explain it. You don't need to say, look, we're doing this, and then the infrastructure of that, and then this and that, and then it helps the lady with the thing. No, if you just say, look, there are car accidents and we save car accidents, or there are families and sometimes they're bereaved and we help them save time and money and stress. Or like there are companies that are mission-driven by definition. And in those cases, the beauty is there is a meaning either way. If you fail because someone else surpassed you, you still win. If you are truly mission driven, you still win. And if you are able to do it, of course, it's a slightly bigger win. But it's a thing that will keep you going on the ups and downs of the entrepreneurial roller coaster, because definitely there's a lot of good days and bad days. But you finish a really bad call and late night and very disappointed, but you never ask yourself, why am I doing this? Or why do I need this thing? You have clarity, at least on that front, in a sea of decisions, ups and downs, challenges, and that's meaning. And on, you know, family meaning, I was never a believer in the concept of a work-life balance formula. And it really depends how you look at it. I often joke that I manage the disappointments. So, you know, you are needed here, so you go there and you fix what's needed to be fixed right now. But in all seriousness, you just need to be present, right? If you're on a call with a client, you have to be with the client. If you're in a meeting with your colleagues, you're in that meeting. If you're at home with your kids, you have to try despite, you know, all these screens and phones and beeps. You got to try best effort to be present. And I think another key narrative that we get to see a lot when we talk to families, but I think a lot would agree, it's a millennial disease, is guilt. Guilt is a very modern feeling in a way, the amount of guilt that this generation has because of the baby boomer age. So many of our generation is taking care of their parents while taking care of their kids, which has a lot of implications on Medicare and U.S. cost of living and, other countries. And what I want to focus on is just the fact that we always feel like someone else needs more of us and we can't do it, but we got to cut ourselves some slack because the star has aligned, and now more people thank God, are in need of us, mostly because of mortality rates and how people get older. And we just feel like we need to be in all these places at the same time.
Learning how to create that balance or boundaries. I mean, even getting rid of guilt, which doesn't help anybody. But I want to go back to what you mentioned in the beginning. Is it important for a company to start with a purpose, like a mission-driven purpose from day one? Or is it something that could come along as you build the journey? I mean, you have a company like yourself, which is mission-driven from day one, helping bereaved families. But then let's say, for example, you have a cyber company, which it could be, I mean, I can't imagine like how a cyber company sometimes could have that mission-driven purpose.
Look, any company could add a mission statement. And many really have an amazing mission. The challenge isn't if it's emotional or not. You know, cyber companies have a great mission. They're like the cops against the bad guys. It's law enforcement, keeping the bad guys and the bad players out of the way. What we need to remember is just a lesson in authenticity when we think about a mission. If you have a gaming company and that company is about making money, and every for-profit entity is about making money, but the mission, they don't say there's another mission. They don't say we're trying to entertain. Some do, but you know, some ads companies, gaming companies, crypto companies say, what we want to do is to make money. That's authentic. It's not sexy. It's not romantic. It's authentic. The problem is in the companies that want to make money and they kind of force a mission. We're going to democratize access to X and Y, but we will never compromise on our gross margin for the mission. Then there is no mission. A mission is something that will balance the entity mission, which is to make money. And my challenge is with companies that are not authentic, not with companies that don't have a mission that is empowering or that is, you know, purposeful. Making money is a mission. Investment bankers, that's their mission. I think it's a legitimate, intellectually honest, and challenging mission. The second they say they're trying to save the world, that's where it gets tricky.
Like what you mentioned, you said the mission statement not necessarily always has to be emotional. Because when we think about mission, we think about, okay, you want to experience that feeling of some type of emotional movement within yourself. But you're right. Like sometimes the mission is just a mission, and that's okay. And being able to also, like the other thing is make money. Sometimes we don't associate mission with making money. It's like two separate things. Like it can't be mission purpose and mission oriented and make money also, because like it's a very important thing over there.
I think if you don't have that balancing purpose, which is empowering and you are committed to, then you don't have the luxury of having something to offset you on those bad days. Because if the only purpose of the entity is to generate value for the shareholders, which is the mission of any for-profit company by definition of the entity, it's okay, but you need that extra layer in order to rally the troops, have people that are engaged in a more meaningful way than just a paycheck.
So turning to your mission of empathy, having interviewed, thank God, thousands of people, especially founders, a lot of times able to see there's always a personal connection to a startup. I mean, no one just starts a startup without that personal connection somewhere. And that could be either conscious or subconscious, but if you go deep dive into the person's history, you're able to come across why they've launched a company. What is your connection to a company like Empathy? And I'd love to also touch upon like, what is your mission of what you guys are trying to accomplish and how you came about founding a company that deals with mortality, deals with death and everything?
So it is a non-trivial category to deal with loss. And I think it's the single largest consumer sector that is still untouched by innovation and specifically unspoiled by software, which is our craft and how we usually look at a problem domain and a solution domain. As you can imagine, nobody goes into the very complex territory of end of life without a personal connection. And this is an inescapable one and a universal one and undeniable one. But I definitely had more than my fair share of loss myself. I lost a brother growing up and friends and family. And it was something that impacted my childhood. And in many ways, just looking at my mom, which is a superhero in so many ways, and the way she raised me and my brother Eyal as a bereaved mother, handling the unique combo of emotional burdens and administrative burdens while keeping us isolated from it as much as possible just by herself. As a single mom, you do learn a lot about the ways that grief has no timeline. But it was only a few decades later when a colleague of mine at eBay lost his wife, and I really learned about the implications of loss in the US and how fundamentally different that is. Why it takes 420 hours on average and 13 months on median to wind down a loved one's affairs, not just emotionally, which again has no timeline, but administratively, like in a country that has gifting tax and estate tax and inheritance tax and probate tax and meaningful commitments, but nobody made a TurboTax for a state settlement. Nobody made a headspace for grief. So in a way, you're asking me about empathy's mission. It's about that. It's about helping all the other moms. It's about helping all the other colleagues. It's about making sure employers can show up in a more meaningful way to help employees bring their whole selves back to work beyond time and pay is a very minimal leave that is happening right now in the state, like 3-5 days of bereavement leave. So how you do that? The mission is helping families deal with loss. And dealing with loss has some weird duality. Grief is made hard by logistics. Logistics are made harder by grief. And we don't think you can decouple those two. And that's what we put together, a very holistic solution. 2 years in and $43 million in funding and 60 plus of us working in the US and Tel Aviv with some amazing Fortune 500 customers like New York Life and Guardian and Goldman Sachs and Guess and just more and more life insurance carriers and employers who say these values, they have value. And if we do it right and we show up for people, we see the value in that.
I'm sorry to hear about you, your brother and all the experience of loss that you have to go through. Your mom definitely sounds like a rock star.
She's the real mentor in the house.
I mean, she raised two crazy boys. So
yeah. Absolutely.
Have you seen, based upon this 2.5 year journey, what are possibly the best ways for people to deal with grief or to offer, offer empathy towards someone else that is going through grief? Have you learned anything about that?
We've mostly learned it's very highly personalized. And that is, again, why you need the holistic solution. Some people at the beginning just say, you know what, the way I'm dealing with grief, the way I'm reengaging with life is drowning myself at work. I'm going to set up the immediate arrangements. I'm going to set up the ceremony. I'm going to write an obituary. I'm going to write an eulogy. I'm going to call Social Security. I'm going to call the bank. I am on top of that. I'm going to clean the house. And for many, the act of cleaning the house is actually a big part of the way they're dealing with their emotions. But at some point, they learn they can't do it. They can't just power through it. There's a 13-month median. So for many families in the US, it will take almost 2 years to handle even the administrative aspects of probate and bank accounts. So they can just keep going and trying to push away their feelings. Others would be completely frozen and have a grief brain, as our chief empathy officer, David Kessler, refers to it. He's the most renowned expert on grief and loss and literally the co-author of the 6 stages of grief after the 5th stages with Kubler-Ross. And he often said, you know, it's very much like alcohol. Like you're making the wrong decisions. You're very, very emotional and not in the best position to make critical transactions. So bottom line is that we've learned it's highly, highly personalized. Definitely do's and don'ts in terms of, you know, what you want to say to people and how you want to engage. But at the bottom line, it's that shift from sympathy to empathy. I think in many cultures, and by the way, Jewish religion has a lot of good, healthy ceremonies around loss. But the Islam has those, Christianity have different ones, Buddhists have different ones, and different cultures and different religions have different aspects to grief. Many of them are very, very different. At the end of the day, there's so much to learn and inject into something that is not going to skip any of us. So if we shift from sorry for your loss and sympathy, like you have your loss, I'm here, you're there, there's a wall, I'm throwing condolences beyond that imaginary wall, maybe flowers, maybe a fruit basket, then I recognize that you are in pain, but I'm not. And if we can shift to putting yourself in someone else's shoes and what we literally call empathy and think about taking action, then it looks more like sitting next to you and just being there, or, you know, asking, what do you need help with right now? Versus, you know, so many big questions.
I guess in grief, you know, what is the true definition of showing up for somebody? I shared this recently. Or really truly love your fellow as yourself. What does it mean to truly have friendship or truly love? And, you know, when someone's going through grief to a certain degree, it's like very easy to show up for them because they're going through grief. So it's like, oh, you know, can I be there for you? Even if they may mean it or they may not, they just say these words like you mentioned. And you have to obviously learn how to tailor it because each individual person goes through their own experience. But to flip it to the other side of happiness, when something good is really happening for somebody, for example, let's say you raise, you know, $46 million for your startup. How many people are truly happy for you for the sake that Ron is doing incredible, that Ron is doing amazing and he's reaching success? As in, how many people are like, you know, jealous or say, oh, he's only able to do it because X, Y, Z, only able to do it because like this. You know, showing up for somebody, true friendship, I guess, based upon the fact of like, I'm happy for you for the sake that I'm happy for you, because that's really showing up. But this is just a point I wanted to bring out. But going back to grief for a second, I want to touch upon that because death is such a topic that no one ever like focuses on. And it's always something we think we're going to live for internal. Like you mentioned in the beginning, you know, it's all about, there's the two stages of having commitment to something, right? And then there's obviously the time constraints around that. And no one ever thinks about death. I mean, at least I don't. I don't know if maybe you do because you're actually working in death right now.
Well, first thing, we hardly use the death word, not because we're running away from it. It's definitely a taboo topic that needs to be broken like any other taboo topic, but that's not something is fixable. What is fixable is how we as individuals, as a society, how we look at the different dimensions of bereavement or loss and the costs of dying, the emotional cost, the financial cost, the employer cost, just physical symptoms of it. That's something that there's no reason technology could not help. Technology is helping with mental health all day. It's helping with taxes. It's pre-filling forms. It's streamlining workflows. It's making calculations for us. Like, why wouldn't we use it for something that's such a, well, one of life's most challenging moments, literally on your worst day of your life? Wouldn't you use any help you can get? And at the end of the day, it's all about finding different ways to save time and money and headaches.
So then what was your go-to-market strategy? I mean, you had this idea about death. You realized that death is a space that no one's ever touched, which I'm surprised myself because like everyone deals with it. What was all of a sudden, okay, you had this idea, you raised some seed around. How'd you tackle that aspect of to bring this to the masses and to actually start talking about it?
So there was definitely some back and forth, and we knew it's a blue ocean, and a few, I guess, niche attempts in the background, people who focused on content or people who focused on obituary. We had the thesis that you need an holistic approach, that it needs to have a very high bar from the get-go. You have enough breath so you can use it as a companion of some sort. Otherwise, nobody needs a solution just for a transaction here or there. When you think about a consumer value proposition, you usually think about things you want to get better at or enjoy. This is how most consumer companies, direct-to-consumer companies, make money. There's a CAC LTV model. They buy an ad, and there's usually a subscription if we're talking about, you know, this time and age. So if you think about Noom, about Headspace, about Spotify, about these are companies you want to be a part of. You don't delete your Strava account because you're hoping to cycle next month. Or you don't delete Headspace or Calm because you want to be that person. You want to meditate. You want to be in control. But end of life, that's not something you want to get better at, right? Like nobody wants to be a better griever or a better executor. This is something you want to get over with. So it's an infrequent product that you want to get over with. just like TurboTax or a Zillow, sometimes even an Airbnb. It's not something you want to use every day or need to use every day. But so as an infrequent product, the best go-to-market would be a place where you can find a lot of people that need the help, but you don't need to acquire them day in and day out. So every enterprise entity in the food chain of loss would have access to what we consider people who need support. So, you know, you can look at funeral homes, you can look at senior living, you can look at hospice, you can look at life insurance and employers and the government and even the ambulance or the florist. And it's really endless because there's dozens of touch points in the very immediate arrangements that people would call or notify that something happened. We decided to focus on areas where we can prove the value without increasing the share of wallet for the bereaved. So we want to save money and time, not increase. So it's actually even more purposeful if you're able to create that win-win-win, because that way the entity could sponsor a service that will help the family and see the value for themselves directly or indirectly, or we get to support the families, do the right thing and not buy the transaction day in and out, because it's not frequent and it's not something that happens a lot to you as an individual, but doesn't skip any of us. So that's the balance. We ended up focusing on life insurance companies and big employers. For life insurance companies, we help them go beyond the payout basis. So instead of sorry for your loss, here's the paperwork, we help them stay with the beneficiary for the days, weeks, and months after the payout, shifting from a transaction to a relationship. There's plenty of value in that if you're managing hundreds of billions of dollars, like all the big life insurance companies. For big employers, you already have fertility care and maternity care and caregiving benefits. And this is just another life transition that is happening in my own intimate private house. And now I can bring my whole self back to work. So enter empathy and we help your employee re-engage with life. These are some of the key models that we're commercializing today in a way that's helping the family without increasing the share of wallet spend on loss.
Funny to even think what a SaaS subscription would look like for death or for empathy. With 2023, currently, January 2023, currently right now, talking about obviously recession and big downturn, death happens to everybody. Recession, good times, bad times, it happens. Your consumer app also, which is very, very different. Does it affect your company? And if it does, how are you navigating? What are the plans you're creating going forward to make sure they're able to come out of this a success?
The need for support doesn't change based on the Federal Reserve or the macro environment. What could change is the appetite that mission-driven budgets get in a financial hardship. And that's why the importance of showing an ROI case that it's not philanthropy, there is a return on that investment, and there is just a positive ROI. That's a model that is actually repeatable in a time like this, but time will tell. We're still early and maybe the budgets still make sense, but the attention is not there. And there's just so many other challenges. Overall, generally speaking, if you got the resources and the talent and the funding to go forward, and usually looking at 2-3 years in advance, depends on how risk averse you are. And some people will say 18 months. We have, thank God, runway for several years ahead and managing the nickel in a way that will help us come out of this, macro environment on the strong side.
You just mentioned an interesting point, and I think this is the way I understood it. A lot of times a company, when we talk about company culture or how the companies show up for their own employees. So, you know, we have the dip family get-togethers, we have the trips, we have many different types of things in order to do team building. But when you actually go deeper and you think about, like, you know, how does a company actually show up for their employees? And this would be a perfect example. And it could be beyond sending the flowers and sending our condolences on behalf of the entire company. It's like over here, we're actually showing up for you.
You got it. It's at the end of the day, there's a limited amount of moments of truth in any relationship, and employee-employee relationship, you know, especially if it lasts just a few years on average, you don't have too many. If one of those big life events, the first child, your recent engagement, Mazel Tov, any, you know, sad or happy life transition that happens in the family, this is an opportunity for the employer. It's an opportunity for any company and their customer base. Think about a big bank in America, no names, but like someone with a, you know, meaningful audience and 10, 20, 30% of the market share. You have a few really big banks. That means that every single day, thousands of families would walk into a branch and say, you know, I need to close down my dad's account. Every day for the rest of their lives, the bank's lives, and inescapable, thousands of people every day. Same thing for a vendor. Think about AT&T, think about Verizon. Think about how all these pointless conversations. I need to close down. That's a life event. That's an opportunity. You can make that transaction a relationship. And for every entity and every relationship, if it's a life insurance company, if it's a communication carrier, if it's an employer, there's a different angle that would be more distilled and accurate for that relationship. You're expecting your employer to show up in one way. You're expecting your funeral director to show up in another way. You're surprised and delighted by your life insurance carrier in another way. And a part of our mission is to create that expectation that people would know what happened to maternity leave in the last decade, right? Like it wasn't a thing in the US for sure. What happened to fertility benefits in the last 3 years? What happens to caregiving benefits in the last 18 months? That's the trend we're following. And we believe it's a big omission in family care.
Has being surrounded by the talk of death constantly or dealing with death changed your perspective or your view on life itself or anything around there?
Well, yes and no. I know it's not very intuitive, but every person who works at Empathy, we don't really think about death. You actually said it on this call more than I used that word all year because it's not something we're solving for. A part of it is, yes, it's a word people don't like to hear and it's just not helping anyone. But a more accurate reason is just that's not what we're solving. That is a fact. I don't know if anyone should solve for that, actually, on a more philosophical standpoint. But loss is something we speak about all the time. And it's a crisis management company. Crisis happens and we get to help. So we don't think about it as, you know, some of my best friends work or lead companies who are sexy and fresh and cool and colorful and perky. And we don't get to do any of that. We get to be the messy, complicated, human, empowering brand that gets to show up and take you from, you know, -5 to +2 on those challenging moments. And we love it. Like there's really nothing sad about it. Once you're in that business and you see, okay, here's a family that needs me. It's like any other healthcare company or any other financial company. You have someone who's in crisis. You have a solution because of technology. It's that decision made easier. It's more cost effective. It's on demand. So we make it accessible. On my personal self, you do realize after not just your customers, but hearing all these experts, they palliative care doctors, the grief experts, the comfort care educators, hospice nurses. Like once you talk to these people, it's a constant reminder how life is short and you do need to enjoy them more and spend time with your kids, etc. But it's against human nature. We take things for granted and we need a reminder. And I'm lucky to have a reminder at work. So every few weeks or months, I get that reminder after a unique, exceptional conversation. Because the truth is, you get used to whatever you're doing. Yeah, you give someone an ocean view, you'll stop seeing it after a few weeks, months. But the constant reminder of something unique coming in, that's what we need. And without being, you know, too zen, I can tell you that what I've learned from others is it's very helpful to imagine your own self-mortality because it will basically help us plan. Anything in life, you want to go from A to B. You say, you know what? I need to do my GMAT. Then I'm going to move to New York. And then I'm going to try to apply here. Like there's a plan for someone who wants to do an MBA or there's a plan if someone wants to be a lawyer. There's even a plan if someone, you know, starting a new relationship in some way or where they want to take it. And life should also have a reverse engineered plan that in a way that says, you know, if when I'm gone, I want my daughters to be happy and independent and grateful and together and not fighting and supporting their mom. Or then what are the steps I need to take today in order to get there? Like are the things I'm doing every week, every month helpful for that dream of mine of how it's going to look like on the best? Because it is happening, right? So that's the bottom line. So yeah, I guess sometimes I do get a little bit zen.
So I want to know, When you get to that moment of Zen, when you have that conversation with somebody that triggers within you some type of moment of inspiration and emotional feeling, and like you start realizing, wait, that I will be gone one day. What are the actions that you do in that moment of inspiration? Is it you going home, hugging your daughters, hanging out with them, or what is it?
You said it, it's action. But action doesn't mean postponing it. So my two cents, and this is something a good friend of mine taught me, is whenever you feel that thing of any on that range of being grateful, it could be even something much smaller than grateful for your kids and family. It could be, you know, someone did the extra mile at the office and you're just thinking of them. That was good job. So you can write them on something on Slack. You can just remember that for next time you speak. But taking action for real would be just going back to that meeting room you just left and say it right away, even if you're going to be late for something else. Like, if you can show gratitude on the spot, I think it's amazing for business. I think it's great for life. And I try really hard to adopt that. I don't always succeed, but sometimes I'll walk 10 minutes back somewhere just because if I had that feeling and I don't want to text them, oh, thanks for hosting or thanks for doing this or thanks for... If someone really did the extra mile, it's not just being polite. You know, that was really special. Thank you for doing that. And with the family, if you're only going to see them in an hour, you should just FaceTime right now when you feel it, right now. I think it's all about taking action. It's all about showing up.
So I want you to imagine that, you know, God willing, in 120 years from now, and we're all sitting at a funeral, but it's a happy funeral in the sense that, like, you know, someone that lived a completely full life. And the person that's giving the eulogy is yourself. And you're giving the eulogy to yourself. There's Ron that lived 165 years and surrounded his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. Everyone's over there. Well, what do you want that eulogy to say?
Well, definitely don't want to leave that long. but I would love to, only if it's true and only if I was successful in it, I would love people to say I was a good friend. Because I think that sums it up.
Such a powerful statement.
Yeah, it's life. You disappoint people, you make other people happy. And if the overall impression you're leaving behind you is that you're someone people can call and, you know, you'll try, you'll do your best. That's what it is. If you have a friend that is always there and helping you, you know, change the tire, you're probably unemployed. Like, it's not about just always, it's about trade-offs. It's about trying your best. It's about compromises. I think, yeah, I hope to be a good friend to my colleagues, my high school friends, my family, my daughters.
It's funny because, like, we think, you know, at the end of the day, when we go to wherever we go, we're not taking our accomplishments with us. We're not taking our money with us. We're not taking any of these physical things or materialistic things that we try to accumulate in our life with us. They're not. What we do take with us is this thing of being a good friend and people knowing us as someone that is dear for others, dear for our family, dear for other people. They're not going to talk about the billion-dollar corporation that we built. Wow. Ron, I want to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting me and for, you know, putting together this podcast that will help curious people and curious kids somewhere make a decision to go after or not. Because the main advice of today is don't do it.
Well, you mentioned a bunch of things that, you know, I'm sure it's going to help them. Learning how to be curious constantly, always try as much as possible, stay naive, surround yourself with good people. But I think the real conversation, the real underlying message is when people are going to listen to this and they're going to listen on a deeper intent, they're going to hear the underlying message on their words. Because most times the conversation is not actually the words being said, but it's the message under the conversation. And at least for me, what I've been able to take so far for this, just actively be participating, and I'm going to listen to it multiple times, is show up for others. Show up, have real empathy towards other people. Don't wait when it's too late. And then you have to have grief and show up from a grief place. Learn how to show up currently right now in a day-to-day life to other people. You know, who could you have more empathy towards? Who could show up with more? And the way how I personally also with an entrepreneurship perspective is that, like, yes, life is fleeting. It is very fleeting. So go ahead and accomplish whatever the dreams you have. Go ahead and accomplish it. Go full force. And it will obviously will have trade-offs to other things. But don't let it lose the main meaning in life. at least for me, which is friendship, family, which is the main purpose. So I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome.